Today we are in the final chapter of 1 Corinthians, our study there. We are going to go ahead and do 2 Corinthians following this. So today and next week we'll wrap up 1 Corinthians and then begin 2 Corinthians. The theme of that study will be a new creation, and taking one of the passages from 2 Corinthians as the foundation for that. I hope you can hang with us for one more Corinthian study, but it just seems incomplete and inconsistent, lacking kind of a synchronized approach to life to do one without doing two. And so we're going to do them both while we're at it. So looking forward to that. I think you will find 2 Corinthians to be quite different from the study that we've just been involved in. Perhaps more instructive as far as discipling and discipleship, and so we'll see that together as we go through it. Some of what we see in chapter 16 borrows a little bit from 2 Corinthians, and we'll see that too, in particular with regard to the things that he's going to introduce at the beginning of it. Paul comes to the conclusion of the letter. Keep in mind, it is a letter. So this is a letter he's written to a group of people, people that he knows, that he shared life with, helped establish the church. They have written to him, or they have sent word to him and said, we have questions about this, this, and this, or these things are going on, or these things are taking place. What should we do? How do we understand this? How do we relate or respond to it? And so 1 Corinthians then is penned in order to answer those questions. And so you're reading a letter that is a response to circumstances or questions that Paul has become informed about regarding situations going on there in the church in Corinth. Now, Paul writes four letters. We only have two, but he makes reference to them. One is a lost letter that we really don't know a great deal about, doesn't have a lot of information in either of 1 or 2 Corinthians about that letter. The other one is something called the harsh letter. And so Paul wrote to them a harsh letter, which is kind of remarkable given the harsh nature of some of the things in 1 Corinthians. But he verbally punished them for some of the things that they had done or failed to do that were causing disrepute to come upon the church and upon the gospel. And so he's very direct in that harsh letter. But now we're kind of on the other side of that, or at least we will be by the time we get to 2 Corinthians. And so this is a group of people that Paul has spent a lot of time with, had a lot of exchanges with, has a deep relationship, sometimes a rocky relationship, but nonetheless one that has endured through very difficult days. And so as we look at this passage together today in chapter 16, he's bringing all of this down to a close, and he says, there are some things that I need to tell you by way of instruction, and he's going to give them just some detailed instructions about different topics. And so there's not one theme that encompasses all of chapter 16 like we've seen in some of the other chapters that we've studied. This one is really more focused on this is a ministry situation that you're in relation to each other within the church, but also in relation to the church in its community and to the larger ministry within the world. And so here's how we participate in that shared ministry and some of the things that we do that will help that ministry to flourish. That's certainly something that's relevant to us today. We are part of a ministry to the church and within the church to each other, but in the community that we are a part of, to the surrounding area or region that we occupy, and then to the larger population of the world as we share the gospel. What was true then remains true today. So the gospel, when it is proclaimed, when it is received, and when it starts to have that transforming effect in our lives, will always promote shared ministry. The gospel promotes shared ministry. So when you see in a church being diverted away from a focused attention on ministry or missions or gospel service of some sort, when you see that happening, you always come back how much time is being spent focused on the gospel as compared to how much time is being spent on a lot of other things. Now, we can get involved in a lot of other things, potentially even good things, but not the best thing. The gospel is the way for us to do this right. So we focus on what Christ has done in our lives, what Christ is doing through our lives, in the lives of the people that we have contact with and that we have been called to minister to and proclaim the gospel to. We focus on that, and then that defines how we serve. Problem is, more often than not, what happens is we focus on ourselves, and then we try to define ministry based on that self-interest. And that never works out. It always creates conflict, division, and it always distracts from the purpose of the gospel, leading not to transformation, but leading to confusion. So Paul is trying to establish, but also to affirm for them the way that they are to go about the service and ministry that he's called them to. So the title of the message is The Gospel Promotes Shared Ministry. We see it in 1 Corinthians 16 in verses 1 through 11. First of all, the gospel and giving. He says, concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, so also are you to do. On the first day of every week, each of you is to put something aside and store it up as he may prosper, so that there will be no collecting when I come. And when I arrive, I will send those whom you accredit by letter to carry your gift to Jerusalem. If it seems advisable that I should go also, then they will accompany me. So, we're now in the period of time somewhere around 60-65 AD. And what is happening is that Jerusalem, where the church was born and where it started, has continued to grow and to expand that ministry out into the world. So the Gentiles now, under Paul's ministry as well as that of the other apostles, the Gentile world is being converted and we are seeing churches planted all across the known land. But back in Jerusalem, where the church is still anchoring things, what we see is very difficult times have come upon them. So a period of famine, most likely brought on by severe drought, lack of food, and the Christians there also being persecuted to a certain degree, this period of famine has come upon them. Paul collects money, takes it back, uses it to purchase food and to provide relief to the people in Judea. They get through that time. Now we are at a different time. A second famine has befallen them. And now what they are facing is even worse than the first, because now they also have a higher degree of oppression and persecution taking place. And so their opportunity to even be involved in the economy of the area, to work or to own property, things like this, has been curtailed by the persecution against the church that is going on there. So Paul is again collecting money, and he is doing so in order to take this back to them. So he's going to come back to Jerusalem, or back to Corinth, and collect the money. Then he plans to go on to Jerusalem, and he gives these instructions. So they're all participating. Churches of Galatia, the church of Corinth is a part of the region of Achaia. And so we see that all of these churches have received these same instructions as to what they are to do and how they are to do it. But the purpose is to provide relief and assistance to those that are in need. Now, what about us? If we're going to make this relevant, are we participating in relief effort today? Well, you need to understand that when you give money to the church, that money is distributed in a variety of ways. A large portion of it obviously goes to maintain all of the things that are going on here. But a very large portion of it, now this year, somewhere close to nearly $200,000 over the course of an entire year, will go to some type of ministry effort. There is a relief effort that takes place every week where we provide financial assistance to people in this community, where we provide food. Sometimes we provide assistance with utilities or housing of various sorts. There are a few things that we limit that we don't do. We don't give cash. We don't buy gasoline. There are some things we just don't do. We transport people. A group of you are part of a volunteer team. It helps people get from one place to the other, or helps people get to a doctor's visit or things like this. All of these are relief efforts. If a member of the church has a need and we become aware of it, or they contact us directly, we do everything we can to be sure that that need is met. And so there's an immediate local ministry that takes place on a daily basis almost throughout every week. And thousands of dollars are given through your sacrifice and through your giving in order to support that. We support relief aid that goes to disaster areas. One of the primary things that the Missouri Baptist Convention does, the Southern Baptist Convention does, that we both participate in, even Franklin County Baptist Association, is disaster relief. We have volunteers that are a part of disaster relief teams. We have others that have served in the past in various roles within that. And so when a storm breaks out, or when a disaster, a natural disaster occurs in this country, the disaster relief teams are dispatched. And they can do everything from providing hundreds of meals a day to workers and to people in the affected area, to providing showers, and they've got an entire trailer that is self-contained and loaded with washing machines and dryers. And it goes to these areas. Tractor, trailer, truck loads of food and water and supplies will pour in to an area of disaster. And the two groups of people that you will see in the United States that show up first will be, number one, the Red Cross, and number two, Southern Baptist Disaster Relief. Never fails. We help out. Are we obligated to do that? Yes, we are. The gospel obligates us to help in times of need. The gospel not only changes us, but changes our perspective on those around us, so that when times of need arise, we respond. Money that you give is divided out through a variety of ways. We give a world missions offering, which goes to our North American Mission Board. It goes to our International Mission Board, and we do that around Christmas time. Some of it goes to the state of Missouri, the Missouri Baptist Convention, and a portion of that will go to purchase food in areas where people are hungry. It will help to drill wells where water supplies are limited. We'll do a lot of different things. That's a special offering that we take. That's not part of your weekly giving. But part of your weekly giving also goes to those same three agencies through our cooperative program. And we, along with every other Southern Baptist church in the world, contributes to that. It's one of the things that makes us Southern Baptist, is the cooperative program. And so that money goes and is divided out and then administered by these agencies, whether it's in a foreign land or whether it's here in North America. It is going to serve in part to help with disaster relief or relief aid of some kind. Now, money doesn't fix everything, but it will help some things. And so when we give that money to support people, you need to understand that we are involved in this kind of humanitarian ministry. Your offerings are being used in part for that. Is there more that we could do? There will always be more than we can do. There will always be more that we can do. That's why we send teams down to Guatemala. That's why we do various types of mission efforts to give first-hand experience to people that want to be involved in a more direct way in helping others and supporting others and in sharing the gospel. But we are always reminded that it is not the need of the moment that drives it. It is the gospel that has transformed us that drives it. If we do it simply because of an acknowledgement of need, then we're always going to be distressed in it. But if we do it because of the transformation of Christ within the heart and mind, so that we see people through through the eyes of compassion as we have experienced that compassion in God's grace, then it makes us sacrificial and selfless, and it gives us a center so that we're not just doing something to help, we're doing something because we know that ultimate help comes through Christ. We represent Him. And so it may be semantics to some degree in the conversation, but I think if you'll go through the entire process, it will make more sense, and you'll understand that what Paul was commanding them to do wasn't something that was abnormal or unusual, but it is the natural response of the transformed life as experienced by the gospel. So the relief effort was an ongoing part of Paul's ministry. And it is likely that they had inquired about it in the letter. Paul's response is simply telling them what to do and answering their question. The collection for the believers in Judea that were suffering was due to the famine. As I've mentioned before, each person, he says, is to give weekly so that the collection will grow until he arrives, and then he will take what has been collected to those in need. Now, it says that they gathered on the first day of the week. This is consistent with other biblical references to the church worshiping on Sunday. This just gives further support to that. Sometimes people will ask, why do we meet on Sunday instead of on the Sabbath day? Because the church met on the first day of the week, and that became the tradition, so that is the day that we meet. Is this day special? It is. It is. It is the day that we set aside to worship. It is the day that is acknowledged for that purpose. And so in that regard, it is special. It is not special because it's Sunday. It's special because it is the day we have agreed that we are going to gather as the church in order to worship God together. You say, well, I can worship God on my own. I can do that anywhere, anytime. You can and you should, but you should do this, not you should not do that in order to substitute it for this. A lot of times we talk about worship as if it is something that has to do only with me. And I need to remind us that our worship is about us. Why do we encourage you to sing out? And why do we encourage you to participate when we worship? Because it builds and we draw strength from one another. And it helps to encourage each other. And it gives us a connection to one another. This is not an observation. This is not something that we get together in order to spectate. This is a participation. So that when the church is participating in worship together, we are strengthening one another. You may be strengthening someone else as a result of the worship that you are engaged in. And that is a benefit and blessing to all. And so when we gather for worship, we do so recognizing that this is what the Bible teaches us. Do not forsake the gathering of yourselves together, as is the habit of some. It is also the reminder to us that when we come together, it's not just for us. It is for all of us. It is for the together part of us. And so there is worship that they gathered together. When they did so, part of that worship was their giving. And so they set aside some portion. You'll notice that he gives them very specific instructions for the collection. He tells them to do so at the beginning of the week. Set aside that according to what you've been given and as the Lord has led you. He didn't tell them to, he didn't designate an amount. He didn't designate a percentage. He designated that they give. It wasn't about equal gifts. It was about equal sacrifice. It wasn't about your gift compared to another. It was about the collection that was going to come together, and it was going to come from the church. And so he just gives them instructions about how to do that. He didn't want to show up and then them hurriedly try to gather together some money that they might have available. He wanted them to do it over time so that they could put aside a portion of what they were receiving every week in order to collect money to support the work that was being done there. is exactly the method that we follow today, and it is something that he instructed them to do as a part of their gathering whenever they would come together for worship. So that he said, when the collection, when I come, there will be no collecting. It will already be gathered together. In verses 3 and 4, he provides instruction for the distribution of the funds. The church will send people with the money, or they may accompany Paul when he goes. Either way, Paul maintains an ethical distance from the money to avoid any misunderstanding, and he connects the church personally to the recipients. So whether Paul is going to accompany them when they go or whether they go without him, the bottom line is that the money is going to come from people in the church that the church has chosen to be the couriers for this. And so there will be a personal connection that takes place between the recipients of the funds as well as the contributors of the funds. It's one of the things that our method of giving today doesn't always afford. And it's one of the regrettable parts of that. I just don't know how to fix it or how to avoid it. The reality is that when you give your money, your tithe each week and your contribution, or when you give to a special need that arises, somebody else is probably going to deliver or distribute that money. You're not going to get to go and meet those people face to face. It's one of the reasons that we do mission trips. Again, to bring you back to a connection, to create a personal connection between you and the people that are being served, whether they are the ones that are going to be the recipients of that directly or whether or not they are going to be just kind of a representative of the people that we are helping and that we are contributing to around the world. The bottom line is that some kind of physical connection that takes place so that you see a face and you connect a name with people that are receiving ministry through what God is doing in this church, it will transform you. Paul knew that too, and he wanted that connection. But he also wanted the connection because I think there was more to this than just them collecting money for people that were hungry. I think that he wanted to also connect the Gentiles in the churches in Galatia, the churches in Achaia, and he's gathering all of these churches together, all of them primarily Gentiles, Greek by birth, and now he's connecting them to the Jews in Jerusalem, Christians who came out of Judaism. Keep in mind that there was a big divide between them ethnically, and so Christianity is kind of bringing that together. The church should always be multiracial, multicultural. Now, it may not be represented well within a particular congregation like ours, but it doesn't mean that it shouldn't be to whatever degree that opportunity arises. Because the church literally is every tribe, every nation, every tongue. The Bible tells us that's who gathers at the foot of the throne when Jesus returns and when the kingdom is consummated. He tells us that that was the intent, so that when he called Abraham, he said, I will make of you many nations. Many nations. There is no place in Christianity for racism. There is no place in Christianity for any sort of sense of superiority because of one particular race over another. That does not exist anywhere in Scripture. Anyone who tells you that is lying to you and will likely lie to you about other things, or they are ignorant of truth and they are conveying something to you as truth, which in fact is a lie. So please do not be drawn into that. I hope that that's not something that really needs to be anchored anymore in our heads or minds. I would hope that the gospel has produced transformation in us to the degree that that is no longer an issue. So it calls us to be reminded of that. And I think part of what Paul was doing through the distribution of money was helping to create some racial reconciliation, some religious connection, some church body life between two groups of people that previously had been very separated from one another. Paul also makes it very clear that he doesn't want any confusion about giving and the money and himself and his ministry. So he has nothing to do with it. If it gives you any peace, I have nothing to do with the money here either. And I mean literally nothing. I don't know the account numbers, the routing numbers. I know which bank, that's it. I'm not on the sign-up sheet. I don't see the contribution records. I don't have password access to the information in the computer. I never have. I never will. I don't want to. And we have other people that you have designated that are responsible for those things. I don't get involved in that. All I do is tell you to give. And if you don't give enough, I tell you to give more. But that's it. I don't tell you how much. And when you do give, I don't know how much. This is one of the reasons why I don't like people to ever give me money. So you forget to put your envelope in, or you come in late and you miss the passing of the plate, or you're not in small group and you don't give it that way. Sometimes people will hand me money and say, can you give that to Mary Ann? And I say to them, go find Mary Ann and give it to her yourself. Now, I don't always do that. Sometimes I will take it because it just, there's just no way around it. Many of you have been around long enough and are old enough to remember Veldon Dickey. Veldon Dickey was, when I came here, a faithful member of this church. And during the early time that I was here, he got sick with cancer and was dying at home. And I would go visit him on a periodic basis or when Mrs. Dickey would call and ask me to. And every time I would go see him, we'd visit a bit, I'd pray with him. She would come in, join us. We'd pray together, and then I'd get ready to go, and he'd say, before you go, just a minute. And he was usually in his bedroom. He'd pull out the drawer in a nightstand, and he'd rummage around in it, and he'd come out with a wad of cash. He'd say, can you put this in the offering for me? I said, I can, Mr. Dickey. I can do that. I said, I'm really uncomfortable with you handing me cash like this. I just wish you wouldn't do it. He said, why? I said, I don't know. It's the same reason that that I was always taught that at church you hug a woman from the side. You know, it's just the proprietary thing, appropriate thing to do to avoid any confusion and to avoid any kind of misunderstanding or appearance of sinfulness. And he said, oh, he said, I trust you. I said, I know you do, and you can, and I'm going to take it straight to the treasurer and make sure that it's put in the church money. But I don't want to be the one to do that. He said, well, would you rather me not give it? No. The man was homesick, and his wife's there taking care of him, and nobody else could do that. I wasn't going to ask him to do it otherwise. I understand where Paul was coming from. He didn't want any confusion. He wanted to be above reproach. That's what this means. When we talk about being above reproach, this is the way it gets done. And so Paul assigned this to the church for a purpose of creating a connection, but he also wanted to be sure that his ministry was not going to be tainted with any sort of innuendo. He'd already been verbally attacked by others, and his ethics had been called into question on more than one occasion, and so he wants to be sure that there is no misunderstanding with regard to this. Yet at the same time, he does not want to create that distance from such misunderstanding to the degree that he's not also going to encourage them to be obedient in giving to help others. So the gospel always promotes giving, and it always gives a consideration for the needs of the others. But giving needs to flow from a transformation that is experienced within as a result of the grace of God, not out of obligation nor in comparison to anyone else. And then in verses 5 through 11, he gives us his travel plans. He says, I will visit you after passing through Macedonia, for I intend to pass through Macedonia, and perhaps I will stay with you or even spend the winter so that you may help me on my journey wherever I go. I do not want to see you now, just in passing. I hope to spend some time with you if the Lord permits. But I will stay in Ephesus until Pentecost, for a wide door for effective work has opened to me, and there are many adversaries. When Timothy comes, see that you put him at ease among you, for he is doing the work of the Lord as I am. So let no one despise him. Help him on his way in peace, that he may return to me, for I'm expecting him with the brothers. In verses 5 through 7, Paul makes it clear that he plans to visit and to stay with the Corinthians for an extended time. His desire to do so would help to anchor the new church in the instructions that have been given in this letter, but he also wanted to connect them to the larger ministry through support and participation of one or more members as he continued to expand the reach of the gospel. So he says, I'm going to come to you. I'm not going to do so just to spend a night or two. I want to come and spend the winter. I want to spend an extended time so that we can really reconnect and build on what we already have. At the same time, I want to give you the chance to be a part of what I'm going to be doing in the future. And so he's connecting them to that ministry at large that he is a part of. And he's helping the churches that he ministers to see how they are all interconnected to one another as long as the focus of each of them is still the gospel. And so this is the kind of attitude that he is trying to develop within the church. We call it today kingdom living. Kingdom mentality. So what does it mean to have a kingdom mentality? It means that we are more concerned about the work of the kingdom and the ministry of Christ than we are about our own particular local interest. Does that mean that we aren't threatened by other churches? Yes, that's what it means. It means that church boundaries are not to exist. It means that as long as we cooperate together in biblically grounded, theologically sound ministry of the gospel for the glory of God, it does not matter who is going to be acknowledged for it. We're not doing it for acknowledgement. We're not doing it to expand the reach of the church, one particular local. We're doing it in order to fill up the kingdom. When we lose sight of that, what have we done? We've become self-centered. We've become me-focused. And that can happen as a church. And now what we do is we start to define boundaries. And now what happens? We become defensive. We build walls. And we protect ourselves from what's on the outside. But you know what happens? Whenever a church builds walls to protect itself from the outside, it also has constructed a prison that keeps everybody on the inside. We have to resist that. You say, well, what about false teaching or bad doctrine or things like that? Preaching the gospel and preaching the truth should overcome those things. So I don't need to tell you what's wrong. I need to spend my time telling you what the Bible says is right. I don't need to point out those who are doing something that may not be consistent with biblical teaching. I need to focus your attention on the biblical teaching. What Paul is doing here is reminding them of all of these things and helping them to see that this isn't just about you. It's about a community of faith. And all of us have the same goal, the glory of God and the kingdom of God. In verses 8 and 9, he says, for the time being, he will remain in Ephesus. It gives further evidence to the location from which he wrote the letter. But it also tells us that he stays because of opportunities for the gospel, even though there was clear opposition taking place within Ephesus. And so Paul says in verses 8 and 9, I will stay until Pentecost. A wide door for effective work has opened, even though there may be many adversaries. So Paul is going to continue to make the most of the opportunity that is set before him and would remain in Ephesus until that opportunity had either passed or he was satisfied that God was leading him elsewhere. But again, why tell them that? He tells the Corinthians that so that they understand that where he is and what he is doing doesn't diminish them in any way. And now they can pray for the many opportunities in Ephesus that Paul has identified for gospel work. And then in verses 10 and 11, he says that they are to receive Timothy and to put him at ease. Now, you know that Paul told Timothy to let no one despise you because of your age. Timothy was young. And so when he wrote the letter to Timothy, he was very young, excuse me. And so he knew that Timothy was taking a little bit of flack because of that. Good catch. He has gotten to the point where he can see my inhale when he knows I'm going to cough, and he turns you off so that you don't have to hear it with full volume. That's really good. So, but there's also this other issue. Timothy comes representing Paul, but they don't want Timothy. They want Paul. And if Paul doesn't come, doesn't matter how good Timothy is at what he does, no credit is given. He said, look, when he gets there, everything that he's teaching you, he learned from me. Everything that he's doing because this is what God has led me to instruct him in, and he's received it well. You receive him and put him at ease because he's a little nervous about coming to you. I've told him what kind of people you are, and he's afraid of you, quite frankly. And so you put him at ease. Don't be mean to him. You be nice to him. And so I understand that. Throughout my years of being, and I know it's hard to remember back that far, but when I was a young minister, there were many of the more mature, older guys that were in ministry that protected me. There were many of you that were older than me that protected me here. And did so with grace and with paternal instinct. And I appreciate it. It's because of that that I am here still. And it's because of that that I am who I am, for good, bad, or otherwise. The same time, God has given me that opportunity now to provide that kind of support, encouragement to the younger generation. What we see has less to do with Paul's relationship with Timothy. It has more to do with developing the next generation of leaders. It has more to do with entrusting what God has given us to those who will come behind us. We need to all be involved in that, regardless of what your age is. All of us are contributing to those who are coming behind us. All of those who are that are here now or have been here for a long time. I mentioned to you Warren's passing. There was a time when Warren served on our church staff as an associate. It was in the early 90s. And that seems a lifetime ago, to be honest with you. But I can remember that Warren would go and make visits, or he would do some of the things that he did as a part of his work here for us. And he would leave me a note letting me know what had gone on. He always signed it the same way, W-A-B. And he had a certain little script, W-A-B. And we always knew Warren A. Brewer. And so you'd see WAB all over the place. And we talked about WAB notes. And did you get a WAB note today? And what did it say? And who was on it? And I always think about that. And I can even see that script. I've probably got some of those little notes taped to various files and folders in my cabinet right now. This is the kind of ministry that God provides us that is multicultural, yes, but also multi-generational. And we need to recognize that there's value within every generation to the degree that each generation, as it moves forward, is passing down all that God has given us so that it is useful for building that foundation that the next one can stand on. That's what Paul was doing. He was helping to build a foundation for the next generation of leaders and ministers who would share the gospel and who would take the cue from him. He says, receive him, help him, put him at ease. And then when he leaves, don't despise him, but help him on his way in peace. In other words, if he needs money, give him money. If he needs food, give him food. But you send him back to me because he's important to me. And I need him here. And I'll be expecting him in due course. And so Paul gives very specific instructions. But if you read behind those instructions, you see the heart and the soul of the relationship. So what does all of this mean? If you're going to wrap it up, and I am, the gospel promotes shared ministry through individuals, through churches, from church to church, from the church as a whole in the world today. But all of it flows from the same thing. It flows from the gospel that has transformed our lives. Listen to this passage that comes from 2 Corinthians, because it speaks to this very issue. It says, "You know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you, by his poverty, might become rich." Jesus, who is the agent of creation and the God of the universe, Jesus emptied himself of all of that, humbled himself to the point of death on a cross, in order that you and I might be redeemed, in order that we might be exalted, not in the way that people would worship us, but in a way that would lift us up from this life limited by sinful flesh, restoring us to the rightful place that God has intended all along as children of his own. How did that happen? It happened through Jesus, who was rich but became poor for us. What is he calling us to do? He's calling us to be reminded of the grace that he has given us that has enriched our lives, making all of these other things in this life so much less important, in order that we might be reminded that this is not about me, this is about his glory, and that he receives the greatest glory when the gospel is actively working in my life to transform me, and through my life to transform others.